The cyber for us is such an ongoing journey. We see that we were wanting to get ahead of the game in getting more scale. And I think to actually be able to innovate and bring our own intellectual property and software development is going to be really important as we move forward.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Kurt Hansen, CEO from Tesserent, and today we're discussing Tesserent's contribution to the 2023 to 2030 Australian Cybersecurity Strategy Discussion Paper. So, Kurt, thanks for joining. It's wonderful to have you on the show, and welcome.
Really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I want to jump straight in, as usual. The shared vision is the world's most cyber secure country by 2030, a bit of a tongue twister there. And we need the unified effort of government, industry, and the community. So, I mean, look, very optimistic. It's a big ask, but what are your thoughts?
Well, look, at Tesserent, we've been on this journey now for sort of 3.5 odd years. You know, in that time, we've brought 13 businesses together to form what is Tesserent today. And that was really a vision back 3 years ago. We saw that, you know, the cybersecurity market had had some larger players that were mostly multinationals. It had a lot of smaller businesses that had great talent, but they didn't scale. So we sought to bring together a business that had some scale that could really bring what we called at the time a cyber 360. So we wanted to bring together the multifaceted things that most clients needed and most businesses needed, most governments needed to help them with their cybersecurity frameworks and their current posture. And that was really the vision of what we tried to bring together. There is no silver bullet in cybersecurity. You know, it's a combination of ongoing attention to, you know, your processes, your people, and the technologies that you're employing and the mix of those things. And of course, awareness is just sits across all of that. Awareness at, you know, senior executive board, senior government levels, awareness of, you know, middle management, awareness of your all of your team members, you know, and of course awareness in the community because of the scams and the attacks and the connection of businesses now to the B2C component, you know, has been really, really important. And it's become very aware, I think, in the community in the last couple of years.
Yeah, look, great word, operative word would be awareness. So what does that mean for you? Because, I mean, I've been in the space for about a decade, and even since I started, it was like, oh, you know, it's about cybersecurity awareness at conferences and, you know, boards awareness. So I'm like, do you think people are sort of getting the awareness piece across, or is there more work to be done? And like, I guess that's yes, but are people just saying, oh, we just need more awareness as sort of like a fallback answer of what needs to be done in our space?
Look, there's always more work to be done. But if I go back, like, you know, you've been in the space, you know, similar time to them. So if I go back a decade ago when I probably dedicated my career, the next couple of stages of my career to cyber, we were having to educate boards and senior management on the importance of cyber. We were having to explain, oh, this just happened in the US and this could happen here. We don't do that anymore. We don't, you know, for the last 2 or 3 years, we haven't really needed to do that. So that means, you know, the boards have all got it, but the issue then becomes, you know, one of my children works in a fairly well-known brand. I won't say who they are, obviously, but after the Optus intrusion last year, you know, the IT security team is running down the corridor. He works in marketing, digital marketing. Of course, they're often the fiends of any large enterprise. You know, the innovation required, that sometimes you have to get around things to get things out quickly. And they're running down with the risk register saying, oh, we need to remediate these risks. And he had a look at the risk register and there was stuff on there from a year ago that had been identified a year ago. This is a major enterprise, right? So that's a good example that even in well-funded, well-organized businesses where they know about cyber from the top, there's a program, there's good people involved, good processes involved. It's really a discipline and it's an ongoing journey of just being at it all the time. The adversaries are always gearing up and getting better, and we've got to always have our defenses to be doing the same thing. It's ongoing training.
So just to press on a little bit more, so on the awareness front, I do hear what you're saying, but how I sort of see it at times is, yes, people are aware and they understand it, but like, do they really get it? And let me explain my point a little bit more. I know for a fact eating McDonald's is bad for me, but I'm still going to eat it. I actually don't eat it, but that's just an example. I'm acutely aware of what it does, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then it's more so, well, I'm still going to do it anyway. So it's like, do you think executives are aware, but are they actually doing anything about it? And yes, you could argue yes, but there's still a lot of people that are aware but then do nothing.
Yeah, it's to, you know, there's cause and effect, and there's the carrot and the stick. And I think there's a lot of carrot stuff that's been going on, a lot of encouraging people for good practices, but you still got to have the stick. You know, you still got to have adherence to policies and procedures. You've got to check. You've got to trust people, but you've also got to have checks and balances in place. And I think you've got to get a healthy set of that, because if the whole focus on IT security or cybersecurity becomes really demeaning and really hard. You know, there are organizations that have gone through these phases where, you know, the IT security department becomes the department of no, you can't do that. So then what happens is, well, you know, the digital marketing team goes, we've got to get around these guys. We've got to go spin up something in the cloud and do it, you know, get what we want done separately, not involving them. That's obviously when bad things happen. It's just an ongoing journey. I think it starts at the very top with awareness. It starts with allocating resources, time and budget into cyber, and then getting the people and getting the right people and understanding that you're going to be on a journey here. There's no end to that journey.
So I want to get into your response. So you've addressed three major pillars. So I'll outline them. So national resourcing strategy, whole of government investment, and then number three would be sovereign Australian capability. So let's start with the first pillar, national resourcing strategy. So tell me more about your approach to this.
Well, there's been a number of studies that have said, you know, we're going to be short 30,000 odd people in 2 or 3 years' time on cyber. And that's obviously worrying some. You know, that's a big concern. So in terms of the critical resource is obviously people that are working on cyber programs from all different facets. And there's a massive skills shortage. Government need to be aware of this. There are multiple programs, education and training, but there needs to be what we've said in our submission was a more coordinated approach, and also recognizing that a lot of educational programs don't necessarily produce the end result of what's needed in a business, you know, within a cyber program. You still need to have, you know, really good on-the-job training. You need to have connections. You need to give people live experiences. And a lot of the academic institutions, you know, don't do that. So we find that people come out after a course or a degree or a TAFE course, and it takes a long time to get them, you know, embedded in you know, into the fabric of being useful sort of cyber people. So what we've tried to do in that sense is you know, we saw this need a few years ago. We came up with the word Testament Academy. We looked at different programs and different things we wanted to do for ourselves, but we went out and one of our 13 acquisitions was actually a training company, ALC Training, which trained last year 3,600 people in 60, 70% of their format of their curriculum is cyber. They do a few other IT things as well around Scrum and Agile and those sorts of things, but largely they've been pivoting towards cyber in the last few years. And we saw that having a training business within our fabric was good for us to be able to accelerate programs for our own training needs. But we saw with our clients that we're doing consulting, we're implementing frameworks for clients. Clients can't outsource that to us. They still have to have people. They still have to own the problem. Those people need to be trained. So we needed to do that particular training. We also see that, you know, the participation, the diversity in the workforce in IT in general, it's been a problem for years, getting gender equal participation in the workforce. In cyber, particularly poor, it's gotten up to about 16% there on average. Tesserent, we're sitting at about 20%. But, you know, that means that there's just this whole massive population that is not participating, and there's lots of reasons for that. So we needed to embed and understand what those reasons are. And a lot of it is about decisions that are made, you know, in the teenager years at high school as to what courses and what interests people do. So we've done programs to go out to, you know, speak to year 10 girls and say, well, you should consider a career in IT and cyber and that type of thing. And we saw that the government needed to, you know, accelerate these sorts of initiatives that we were sort of been looking at doing as a, you know, as a company.
So you mentioned something before, Kurt, and you said students are coming out of TAFE courses, et cetera, but then it takes a while for them to be embedded into the fabric. Why is it a while after they've just done a course?
Well, they've done a course, they've got an accreditation, but the next thing is you know, you can learn skills in cyber, and there's different themes to cyber, whether you're going on the technical testing side or you're looking at process, governance and framework. But a lot of it is successful people we've got in cyber that are working in cyber inside businesses and helping businesses defend themselves. It's also a way of thinking. It's learning the people skills that are needed. It's learning, you know, the thought processes behind it. You can learn the skills, but you've also got to have that EQ as well to be able to be a really successful, you know, cybersecurity practitioner. It isn't just about having technical skills.
Most definitely not, especially if you want to, you know, go up the chain and you want to lead teams and you've got to influence some CFO guy to give you money, right? Like that comes down to EQ.
Well, I often say, you know, the core competence of a chief security officer often, you know, it's people skills, big, big core competence. It's project management. You know, there's a range of projects that need to be rolled out by any, particularly all the larger businesses. And so you end up, you know, managing projects, return on investments of those projects, presenting the, you know, the financial, you know, the benefits or the risks associated with that to effectively the board in many cases. So there's a deep skill set there that's not, and that is not taught in universities or TAFE colleges.
So, okay, I want to talk you through something and I'm keen to get your thoughts. Now, I had a young gentleman approach me on LinkedIn a few weeks ago and he said he was looking for a job in cyber. Now, I'm not in cybersecurity recruitment, unfortunately. He was previously working in IT and then he mentioned he found it increasingly difficult to find a job in cyber and then wanted my advice. So this has been something that's come up for years, as you're probably acutely aware of. And if I even look at myself, like on paper, I don't think I look that good. I don't have a university degree. I don't come from some prestigious university or college or whatever overseas or whatever it may be. So it's like on paper, I'm probably not great, but I haven't put together a CV for a number of years. But I know when I get in front of someone, that's fundamentally different. So I want you to hold that thought because then, you know, going back to my question, if you hold that point I made about myself, would you say that companies hiring talent are then just too narrow-minded, like when it comes to then recruitment? Because like on paper, if you were to filter me, it'd be like, oh, Carissa Breen probably gets filtered through. She's not, maybe nowadays is a little bit different, but if I go back a few years, it'd be like, you don't have the university degree, you're already out.
I think you're right. I think we probably have been, many different companies, including even ourselves, that we have been often very narrow-minded, you know, in making hiring decisions and expecting people to be already ready to go. And quite often with the scarcity, we've sort of had to bridge that gap and bring people on board that weren't ready to go. And we've had different experiences with getting people productive. And I think we've learned a lot along that particular journey. And what we've learned is, you know, yeah, university degrees are great, but that's not the only entry level into cyber. You know, the TAFEs are doing a great job. People who have worked through OH&S, accounting, other schemes have developed really good people skills, really good framework skills, and they can learn cyber pretty quickly, you know, with some of the certification courses, and they can be very effective cyber practitioners, maybe even in a shorter period of time versus someone who started off their career thinking, I want to be the best cyber hacker going around. And this is one of the things we took to the government and we said, you know, we as a business, we're good at hiring, we're good at training people, we're good at getting people embedded in clients and working on problems and we could do, but obviously we're a commercial business, we have to make a profit at the end of the day. We and other businesses like ourselves could do a lot more. So there could be programs or grants or schemes or things that could be thinking more strategically about how we could actually, you know, bring more people on board. Because really when I've seen people develop themselves from entry-level sort of roles that I've had at the company, and when I've seen them sitting next to very senior people working on the same problem, getting mentoring, coaching, that's where the rubber really hits the road in terms of people becoming productive and really useful in the cyber, as a cyber practitioner.
Okay, so a couple of things then on that point is people have got to come from somewhere. Now, you could go and talk to Bill Gates. He did come from somewhere. He used to be a no one. It does appear, though, that like organizations are unwilling to make concessions to train new hires. And I guess working in a corporation myself historically, for example, it's like we need to hire this person. I knew on paper, and I'll give you the story so you understand, it's probably a lot of people other pain points as well. We knew who we wanted to hire, but we only had X amount of recruitment companies on the panel. But then we have to run it through internal talent acquisition who goes out to an agency. And the agency I wanted to use wasn't on the MSA or whatever it was. So they got knocked back. So then they went through this whole rigmarole process. They came back with someone who they thought were amazing. And we're like, this person is the actual opposite of what we wanted. So it's almost like there's so many cooks going on because if you're the hiring manager, you've got to follow, I mean, if you're a large corporation, you've got to follow the talent acquisition person. Then they go out to an agency. Now, maybe the agency knows more the internal talent acquisition. I mean, whatever. But it's more so by the time it gets back to a middle manager, it's like this person that we thought we were going to hire is fundamentally different. And then I think it's like we're actually hiring now based on all of their certifications and, you know, where they went to university, but we're not actually hiring for talent and capability. That gets missed a lot. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that there are some steps between you know, hiring managers in businesses like ours and in clients as well are very busy people and they just want to get the job done. And so there's only so much, you know, thought and attention they put into that. And then they do get surrounded by people and culture, talent acquisition, and there's noise in the industry around what they think that person needs. And I think that comes back to, you know, I think the hiring managers also have to step back and have a think about, and if I come back to that, this question also linked to diversity as well. And I said to a particular hiring manager of mine a few years ago, this person's not with us anymore, he's moved on to somewhere else, but I said, you probably need a bit more diversity in your team. I think, you know, it's a fully male team. And he came back at me and he said, Kurt, do you want me to hire second best? And I said, is that really the way you think about things? I said, no. I said, well, how about for a start this? I'd just like you to start interviewing people from the other half of the human race. And then, you know, we had a chuckle over that. And then all of a sudden, you know, we actually started to hire more diverse. I mean, he got that message and he said, you know, he was in a sort of a trying to get the job done, so busy, trying to get the skills, trying to replicate what he already had rather than thinking, how do I solve this problem? How do I get some more people to do some of the things I need to do in my team? And, you know, then he started to actually actively look at hiring some, you know, females into his team. And it was a very successful program from there. One of the practical things I think we've done recently at Tesserent is we launched a program, which actually just started this week. We called it 100 Students in 100 Days. We had our Tesserent Academy program manager, Linda, go out into the marketplace and talk to some universities and TAFEs and get to know some students and market to students that were already doing some practical, you know, cyber degrees or courses or whatever. And then we said, look, we're going to fund a 5-day course. And we'd like you to apply for it. We're going to have 3 days of theory. There's going to be a certification exam. And this was a modified ALC training course we put out there. And then we're going to have some of our senior consultants come and work with you on day 4 and 5. So in Melbourne, I think we're in day 4 now. So we started on Monday. So we're day 4 and 5. And then that's going to be a 5-day program to get you an accelerator into a role. And we're going to do 100 of you in 100 days in the 3 months. We're doing Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth as well in this sort of 3-month period. And I just had some feedback from the first course this week and I think we had 25 students on the Melbourne course. All of them have passed the exam. Some of the terrific talent we've noticed there. Our aim with this 100 students is to look at, you know, we probably want to hire the top 10 of them into our graduate type entry level program. But more importantly, we're actually accelerating their connection whilst they're doing academic stuff back to a real live business, and they're getting to meet practically like right now today. You know, we've got the heads of a couple of our practices in there working with them. They've set up labs to do pen testing. Tomorrow is all about governance, risk and compliance and frameworks and that sort of stuff. So we're giving them a real connection to senior people in the industry that are actually doing the role that are, you know, on the front line right now. So I think that was that's one small thing we're trying to do to sort of solve that problem.
Yeah, look, and every sort of small thing that people are trying to do, once you add those things up, they become big things. So let's talk about diversity. Now, I'm just going to be very upfront in saying, I don't like people who virtue signal. Everyone comes out, oh, diversity, this and that, does nothing. So as I said to you before, I'm definitely a walker and not a talker. So what would be, from Tesserent's perspective, putting your money where your mouth is, and yes, you alluded to that stuff before, but would you say there are people out there that are saying they're doing diversity but in fact are not?
Oh, that's a big accusation, I think. Yeah, but I do get the point. I do get the point. People do. It is a much bandied word. And when we say diversity at Tesserent, we don't just mean the male, female gender thing. We mean, you know, all sorts of diversity. So in our future, in our thinking around molding and building our future teams, it's diversity means when we talk about entry level, we're going mature age entry level. In this program I just spoke about, we've got some, you know, I think there's one particular gentleman who's, you know, wife is the primary income worker. He's been looking after the kids at home. He's been studying cyber in his spare time. I think he's in his late 40s and he's apparently a terrific sort of candidate for someone to hire. And we've accelerated that this week. And so we like to think that there's a lot of people that, you know, this industry is growing and we need to be able to bring people in it at all different levels. So it's not just adding more female. But of course, you know, the statistics are pretty startling when you look at the industry's got 16% female in it. I mean, so there's massive opportunity for upside there. So I think you do have to talk about it. You do have to make it an issue. you still have to run a business and you still have to hire skills and you have to hire, you know, the resources that you need to get the job done. But if you don't, you know, since we've been doing that for sort of many years now, and we've found that the more that you discuss it and talk about it, I think it's also about helping in our business. We've worked really hard to look at, we've just started a leadership training course and we're really keen to have some of our particular technical females, because I think more leadership positions in companies, more hiring managers that are females are going to also fix the balance issue. So I think if you brought our people and culture on here, there'd be probably 10 initiatives that we're doing across the business to improve our female diversity issue. But diversity as a whole is something that, you know, we are really focused on, and I'm really proud of that.
And yeah, look, that probably was a big accusation. I just know for a fact of being in this space of people coming out and saying, oh, we're doing this thing, but then the rubber meets the road. There's no rubber meeting any road. And so it's more so I have this show to cut through the noise. I don't like fluff. I like to get answers from people that people are asking in the market. And I want to hold people's feet to the fire. If you say you're going to do it, do it. Practice what you preach.
Oh, that's true. And I think what, you know, the programs we took when we sort of brought these businesses together last year, we started to obviously corporatize ourselves a bit, and we put systems in place to start to measure employee workforce and what it looked like. And it's funny, you know, it's like any sort of scoreboarding when you've got, you know, business units that suddenly every month we look at the ratio of female males and these types of things. People's then, if it becomes an issue for the board, which it is, the board asks me about how are we going with employee programs, what's happening with retention, what does diversity look like? I have to turn up at a board and answer those questions. We talk about it at our senior leadership meetings, and that cascades down. And so people start to pay attention to it, and then good things happen. And I've, you know, specifically noted, if I look at the last sort of 18 months particularly, there's been some businesses that, because we've been sort of actively talking about it, and not just talking, commanding, and saying, it's obviously how can we help? You know, how do we get involved with AWSN? How do we, you know, like I said, how do we actually look at accelerating the promotion of some of the managing consulting roles, leadership roles, to actually also then look at hiring? And also, as an outside look, you know, if young women are wanting to come and work at a place like Tesra, and then, you know, all the hiring managers are sort of males. I mean, I've got my three kids, two of them are daughters, and I can imagine what they would think moving into that sort of workforce. So you've got to obviously over time look and change the nature of what you look like, you know, as a business. And if you focus on it, we've seen demonstrable things. Now, are there people in the industry that are saying stuff and maybe not following through? Maybe there are, but, you know, we're pretty caught up with what we're doing at Tesra about it.
So I want to understand from you, Kurt, as a CEO, how do you balance being genuine in the market on, and what I mean by that is, okay, like from the diversity side of things, like it's not more so like we're filling quotas and all, remember all of that stuff that sort of went around a few years ago, like it doesn't matter about that. It's just more so how do you balance, yes, we care about these things, but we're actually genuine then about it? Because then it also goes the other side of my thinking, people saying we're doing these things, but I don't know whether that's disingenuous or not. It's like, oh, we're just doing it because that's what we should be doing because it's good PR or it's good this or that. So it's more so how do you balance that with saying we genuinely actually care? I mean, want to make these changes?
I think it's a leadership issue. And what we talk about as leaders, it's just diversity just makes teams work better in every way. And obviously we can talk a lot about gender diversity, but as I said before, there are other forms of diversity that we focus. And I think diverse teams, time and time again, in all different industries, and there's plenty of examples of it, diverse teams are healthier mentally, they make better decisions, And they are not as one dimensional. And so, you know, I think there is such a benefit to wanting to work in a diverse environment. And I think where we're at the moment is, I think we have, you know, all of our senior leaders and middle level leaders are very focused on it. And, you know, Patrick, who runs our SOC, just rang me up yesterday and he said, you know, we've just opened up a SOC operation in the UK for our 24/7 monitoring, and we're doing some stuff in federal, and so we've got to have Australian citizens in the UK with security clearances to be a SOC analyst. And he said, we've just found one. She's just decided to move to the UK, and we've just given her an offer. And he's just like, just hearing the excitement in Patrick's voice, saying that, you know, he's building his team out. He's found a female SOC analyst engineer, going to get a security clearance, and he's going to work in London, part of the team. And that whole team that Patrick's been running for a while now is a highly diverse team. So yeah, we couldn't be happier with what's happening there. So it's really just building that enthusiasm into wanting to create that environment. And, You know, it takes time for and you have to have role models of building diversity and point out these successes that we're having, like what Patrick's doing, and other people start to get that.
So let's switch gears now and let's focus on the second pillar. So the whole of government investment as a reminder. So what do you mean specifically by this statement?
I mean, I think the government have responded by appointing the cybersecurity coordinator, but clearly we saw like the rest of the industry saw, we saw a number of areas of government. There's obviously defence, home affairs, all the other government departments. There was obviously a potential disconnect between what the overall national strategy needed to be and where it was obviously being worked upon. So now the government have made steps to bring that together. So obviously we commented about that. I think the government, you know, we've given advice around, I think the government has sort of said, you know, how much do they want to regulate about cyber? You know, the ministers talked about, you know, fines for not doing this or don't pay the ransom. So, you know, it's like telling a commercial organization not to pay something. There's a whole lot of thinking and evolution still needed in Australia to mature, you know, how we think about cyber and what the actions are of government and how that then connects in the industry.
So one of the things that's interesting from my point of view as someone who is a startup and I work a lot with sort of startups is in one of your priorities, you mentioned that leverage federal purchasing power by sourcing tools and automation for best practice outcomes, which is your statement. So would you say that cybersecurity startups in Australia are overlooked as they don't have the financial records to tick the boxes from a procurement perspective? You haven't been around for 10 years, so we're not going to bother.
I mean, you talk to some of the startups and, you know, they've been tapped on the shoulder to say, hey, bring your business over to the US and we'll get you funded. So the VCs are funding them. You've got programs in other countries such as, you know, USDO Defense, have actual budgets associated to invest in startups that will do some specific things for them. So I think our government really need to be thinking about, you know, we're a small population globally. So if you're a startup and if you're developing a cyber software product, it's a relatively small market. So you are going to be tempted. You want to get that global, but you still maybe don't want to relocate. You still want to stay in Australia. So there's a lot of programs, I think, that need really close attention. You know, we were a small investor in a company that recently went insolvent called Daltrey Biometric, a biometric identification. We thought that was a great story. We really wanted to support that into the market. And they were doing some great things in government. VC funding fell over. The government wasn't moving fast enough for them, I think, in terms of support. And that was a real sad story if you actually, want to unpack that one at some point.
Yeah, it is a sad story. And it is sad for Blair because I do know him. I've interviewed him before. So this probably goes into maybe my next question then for you, Kurt, is because of these barriers for startups to work with government, as you've just alluded to, it means potentially as well that as a consequence, the government may miss out on working with companies who do solve their problem. I mean, look, I can tell you firsthand, I know some really great startups in there that actually would challenge these big boys and these big players that have been around for so long, to be honest, in terms of capability, but they haven't been around for that long, so they miss out. So then my next question would be, that then means the government purchasing power will just continue to feed the large big boys and potentially drown out our startup ecosystem as you've just experienced.
Carissa, you're exactly right. So we've directed, I mean, we've suggested government definitely need to look at that and they need to look at that startup ecosystem. But it's also self-selecting as well. There's a vicious cycle goes on here because I know people in the startup industry, some of the businesses that have become Intesserant, they weren't operating. We've obviously got a very strong federal government business through four acquisitions of the 30 we've made. We're going well in Canberra. I think we're the largest cybersecurity consulting business in Canberra, and we're bringing other capabilities in there. But we had businesses that were in Sydney and Melbourne, particularly a couple of the Sydney ones, and their view was not going to Canberra, not going to go and take out our offering to Canberra because it's just too hard. Sales cycles are too long, investment's too long. So you've actually got some startups that I've heard that I've spoken to, you know, they don't want to go down the rigmarole of investing in sort of working with government. So that's quite sad as well. So then government's not even been given the opportunity to perhaps get to know these startups and invest in them.
Well, it's sad that they're not even bothering because they know the exact outcome. Nowhere takes too long. I'm out of business.
I mean, startup, you've got to be good at sales. And so in sales, you make qualification. You go, well, where am I going to invest my time? I've only got so much time. Is the enemy in sales, is the number one enemy. So where do I spend my time? government's hard, procurement cycles are difficult and long-winded, I'll spend my time doing other things.
Yeah, look, I know it well. So how's this going to change? Because, I mean, look, it sucks and it is a sad story. Like I said, there are some really great players out there who offer really great stuff who are probably a tenth of the price in some of these big companies out there. But then if I was a big company, I'd be laughing to be like, oh, well, I know I'm going to, you know, blow these other startups out of the water, so I don't care because I know the government's going to keep funding me because I've been around for 50 years. So how's this going to change though?
That's the good old, you don't get fired if you're a procurement person, a CIO. You don't get fired by an IBM. We used to talk about that. So there is a bit about, there is a conservatism in government, in procurement. There always has been. It's going to be difficult to shift. But if the government want to also, and, you know, I was with Home Affairs executives recently in Canberra, and, you know, there is a real intention now, and the minister's really stirred this up, but there were some good people there before this minister too. They understand that they need to be able to direct some of the government purchasing into our local industry. You know, we learned through COVID with other industries, we can't be reliant upon everything coming from overseas. So we have to have critical mass of some things. It can't be everything. It won't be everything, but there has to be critical mass that's developed as a local industry. We've got to, you know, bootstrap that local industry. We've got to support it wherever possible. And that means sometimes we need government people to be making decisions to say, I'm going to take a risk and go local small startup. And I'm going to say no to Mr. Big Guy just because you've been there. You've been well funded and you've been sort of marketing to me for many years. You know, back off. I want to give this a go.
Yeah, look, great word, conservative. They're very conservative. So then going back to the original question around 2030, we're not hit that if we just keep going by the same players every time. I mean, stuff's coming out left, right, and center in terms of cyber criminals, new threats. We need to be focusing on startups that are actually growing this technology that maybe big players just don't have. So how are we going to hit that goal if we're not even looking at the people in our backyard and we're just going for the same old, you know, same old people, the same old people get picked for the team? And I don't know, I question on how we're going to get there if this is not going to change fundamentally.
Well, I think the strategy paper was a good thing. I think there were, there were a couple of hundred, 250 odd responses to it. The people that I've met in Home Affairs that have been sifting through that for the minister, I think are very genuine people. I think that there's a reality of change. This is not a problem. This problem that we're talking about has been existent in other industries, and it is a generational thing. I think that we spoke before we started the discussion around awareness. There is a lot more awareness about it now. So I'm quite optimistic about things changing. And I think that we just have to now wait and see the minister and the new coordinator and some of the new thinking that's obviously been happening in government is actually going to move the needle.
And you're right. All I care about is moving the needle, getting these people some of the attention that they deserve. And you mentioned something before of maybe government sitting back saying, oh, is this company a risk? But it's like, well, maybe they're actually not. Like, are they a risk? Like, maybe they're actually really good at what they do because they care and they want to actually do well. So I think that I hear exactly what you're saying. I'm just all about challenging the status quo, getting people like yourself to come on, give your opinion, hopefully that, you know, can spread that awareness in our own light of having these discussions openly and frankly. Let's dive in maybe to the third pillar. So the sovereign Australian capability. It's been a big sort of topic of discussion even the last 12 months because of everything that's happened around us. And like you mentioned before, Kurt, why should we as Australians be reliant on things from overseas? And I guess that's changing. Maybe explain your definition of this, because every time I think of this, I just think of that little green logo with Australian made with the kangaroo on it. I want to see more of those signs coming back with the little kangaroo on it.
Yeah, look, I think that's quite an emotional thing, the little kangaroo, and that's quite valid. And I think we should, as Australians, all want things to be, you know, to be more Australian made, to be more, you know, invented here, manufactured here, delivered by people working here and not offshore. I think these are all themes that we've all been through, and I think we have to hang on to them. But I think the reality is cyber is a global problem, and it can't just be solved by local solutions. There are global solutions that are quite relevant. There are relationships that Australia, you know, whether it's our defence policy, our multinational policy, and that filters down into IT and cyber, there are relationships that need to be maintained to have, you know, good connections into the cyber world. And I think sovereign in my thinking has really evolved that, you know, we definitely need more local capability. And that has to be, by its very nature, a combination of, you know, local, you know, Australian-based capability, but also multinationals building capability, you know, on our soils in Australia, in New Zealand, in places like that, and really, you know, investing in this part of the world and not just doing a drive-by.
What do you mean by not doing a drive-by?
Well, a drive-by, you know, coming in, selling something, moving on, not maybe investing in, you know, people and infrastructure, you know, locally. So I think the definition of sovereign, it's a good one, but it has to evolve in terms of, you know, really we have to rely upon that, you know, companies, be they owned by local Australian shareholders or multinationals, really need to be investing, you know, in here. If you look at the big four consultancies, technically they're multinationals, but I note, you know, PwC has made some big investments in Adelaide around a cyber practice. I mean, that's fantastic. To me, that's a sovereign initiative. That's hiring Australians, it's developing capability, and it's coming back into our local economy.
Yeah, okay. So that's what leads me to my next question. So there's definitely companies out there allegedly claiming that they're sovereign, but in fact, they are not. So what would then be your approach to ensuring companies are being, like, governed to maintain, like, their sovereignty? Like, because anyone can come out there and say they're sovereign and they're not, and then they're winning all the big contracts. How's that fair for anyone else?
Yeah, exactly. Look, I think it's an overused and generalized term. I mean, I always thought that. I mean, this, I think it was 3.5 years ago, one of our big competitors started to use it. And I sort of had a look at that and went, well, gee, really, you're backed by venture capital money that's coming from the Canadian Pension Fund. That's where your shareholder is. So does that make you sovereign? Does that make you sovereign? He thinks he's sovereign. They all think they're sovereign. But then obviously they've gone overseas and set up in the UK and the US. So they've become a multinational Australian headquartered. They call themselves sovereign, but their money comes from overseas. We obviously looked at the fact that as we brought 13 businesses together, we're an ASX traded business. So obviously that means most of our 11,000 shareholders are probably based in Australia. It doesn't mean they all are, but probably a good percentage of them are. You could call us sovereign. And I just mentioned we've opened up in the UK to do that. We believe we can have better people working normal hours in London rather than people working at 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, in Sydney or Melbourne. You know, we think we get a better quality of analyst looking at with eyes on glass, looking at cyber events that way than we do having people, you know, but we've got a capability to do both. You know, we're not a big outsourcer to, you know, other countries to sort of cheaper labor costs. And that's sort of, we're about building capability here in Australia predominantly. And I think that's been sovereign.
Yeah. So how do we govern it though? Because it's like, I always feel like there definitely are people who've said we are sovereign. And I know for a fact that they're not. But then it's like, but they've already won the contract. They've claimed they're sovereign. But then it's like, okay, but then 6 months down the line, I'm going to outsource all my capability to wherever, Timbuktu. Does anyone follow up to say, hey, you're still sovereign? Or like, what's the go there?
You know, good question. I've seen examples of that as well. I think it's just got to be called out when it is. I think, you know, who's signing off on this stuff though, right? And I think the rubber's going to hit the road, you know, the rubber's going to hit the road there. So I think that's just, I think awareness, talking about, once again, this word awareness, I think the awareness of that, I think is a really good debate to be having as an industry.
So when you say people who are signing off on it, so you mean like they should be doing their due diligence and maybe looking at things a little bit closer than just claiming what someone says? Because I mean, anyone can make a statement saying, oh, we're leading this. So many companies out there on their website, oh, we're leading. And you know, I've literally said to people, who said you're leading? Who? And they're like, no one, we did. Yeah, we made that out. Everyone's going to say, oh, we're sovereign. Okay, show me. Show me that you are. Where? What about your data centers? Where are they located? Who knows is probably the answer.
Well, so I guess it's a definition of sovereign. So maybe there's some work that needs to be done to actually define the meaning of sovereign and what we actually mean by that.
And that's the point that I wanted to stress on the show today. What does that mean? Because I think there are variations to what that means to people, and there are caveats, and there's, oh, yes, but this, oh, we are sovereign, but our money comes from overseas. So that's the part where I think it gets a bit confusing.
I think that there are different people are going to pull those different definitions to suit their own purposes. Buyers are still going to decide on what they, you know, what they really value. And, you know, so I think it's a good topic to be made more aware in the industry. You know, the old buy local, think global is a good analogy. But I don't think that there's any silver bullet that I've got, you know, just to solve that one, other than just, it's great that someone like yourself is passionate enough to actually raise that in many different forums.
Yeah, and look, I don't expect you to have all the answers. I don't expect anyone to. It's just more so, what do you know? How do we share insights? How do we have a conversation about it, which may inspire someone to do something about it? That's all it really is, and it's just having an opinion. So do you have any sort of closing comments or any final thoughts, Kurt, you'd like to leave our audience with today?
Look, I think it's been a great discussion. And I think, as I said, I think it's about the cyber for us is such an ongoing journey. We see that we were wanting to get ahead of the game in getting more scale. And I think that's what we feel was needed in the industry, was to build more scale, more ability to be able to do larger projects, to do things, you know, like being able to fund the academy and build that out is really important. The other thing that we're doing is test and innovation, which is actually developing, you know, we've been working inside clients, developing IP that's often owned by those clients, particularly in the federal arena. We've been able to bring some of that IP back, and we've launched a whole program around innovation, which is going to be deliver some really exciting, you know, locally developed products. And unlike a startup, we actually have a distribution into client. You know, we're dealing with 1,300 clients. I think we've got 36 client executives that are covering the market. So we're in a really good position to be able to innovate and do and make a difference in many different ways, not just as a cybersecurity consulting services business, providing managed services, but also we obviously resell some, you know, global software products as is needed, and manage those products or do professional services around them. But to actually be able to innovate and bring our own, you know, intellectual property and software development is going to be really important as we move forward, you know, on the Tesserent journey. So we don't have all the silver bullets either. We're just doing that. We're trying to do our own thing and commercialize and scale what we do. So I think that there's still a lot of things that are needed in the industry, but it's great to have the conversation with you today about some of these matters.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.